Welcome to the Mindfulness Podcast. This is Dr. David Black, Director of the American Mindfulness Research Association. My guest today is Dr. Lynn Waldie, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at Palo Alto University and Adjunct Clinical Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University School of Medicine. Her clinical and research focus is the treatment of stress disorders, particularly PTSD, using mindfulness and meditation approaches. She created the Inner Resources Program, a therapy for PTSD, and she trains clinicians across the globe using this Inner Resources treatment protocol. Her new book is just out, titled Mindfulness and Meditation in Trauma Treatment, the Inner Resources for Stress Program. Welcome, Dr. Waldie.
It's great to be here.
Great to have you. There are a lot of stressors in our environment. I think we're all pretty well aware, especially as adults, that there's stressors that abound in the world, from work to our children being in school to pandemics. So maybe we'll open up about like what makes PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, different in the minds of people who have it versus someone who's just stressed out. I think it's important we know this clinical difference.
You know, I think researchers and regular people might make very different distinctions here, because I've interviewed, hundreds and hundreds of people for a trauma diagnosis. And so often when you ask someone who's experienced many, many traumatic stressors, what was the worst thing? And sometimes they name something that wouldn't fit the conventional definition of a trauma, like a grandparent's death, as an example. And so I've seen over time that this word trauma gets used to, it represents extreme stress for people, stress that seems disjunct with their regular experience and something that's at an unacceptable level to them. And I think that's an entirely accurate way to use the word. Now, in a diagnostic framework, you think of what separates a traumatic stressor as something that involves a life threat, either to yourself or someone that you love, or experience hearing about a life threat or a threat to bodily integrity. And so I think, diagnosticians make the distinction that a traumatic stressor involves a threat to a person's life or bodily integrity.
Is there a short list of, and I know what you did with your definition, you just broadened it, but is there a short list of what you would say are the classically recognized causes of PTSD?
There are short lists if you go to checklists, measures of exposure to traumatic stress. There's the common ones that are listed, but I don't even know if those are the common ones in people's experience. So, checklists of exposure are used to screen people for exposure to traumatic stress. And it always struck me as kind of funny because, national epidemiological research shows that like 70 or 80% of people in the United States have had one or more of those. Right. And so the classical things are like exposure to a natural disaster, a natural hazard or a natural disaster, being assaulted, being in a car accident, things that are very high impact and discrete events that have an obvious beginning and end. But what about those severe stressors that don't have an obvious beginning and end? The things that are very chronic and very debilitating and interfere with our ability to have the kind of life that we're expecting to have. And so that's when the definition gets a little bit less clear. Nowadays, we have the idea of complex traumatization. Trauma that is ongoing, and especially trauma that starts very young, that might be the result of child abuse or extremely adverse circumstances. So there's a lot of definitions of trauma out there, but I don't, I totally understand if people feel traumatized right now because we feel very cut off from life as we're expecting to have it and from the supports that sustain us.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, I have a parent who feels that way after 2 years of kind of isolation, just saying, I don't recognize the world anymore. Is that like a statement that someone with PTSD or a general syndrome connected to PTSD might be reporting something like that, like just a total disconnect from what this world once was?
Well, and so here it's helpful to distinguish between the exposure to a trauma and the response to it. Because a person who would qualify for a diagnosis of a stress disorder has really altered experience that's altered in a consistent way over time. And so they may truly feel out of control because they're having intrusive experiences, re-experiencing the trauma when they weren't expecting to, by being triggered by reminders of the trauma, making a lot of effort to avoid reminders. And so that, you know, having a diagnosis isn't just based on what you experienced or what you were exposed to, right? It's based on some very painful and distressing and long-lasting responses to it. So people feel like they can never get away from it because they're being triggered by reminders and their ability to respond is constrained by that.
Yeah, I remember being interested in that part of your writing in the book. It was really focused, you made that definition clear, that PTSD being the focus on the way people are responding and then reacting and changing their lives and the way they're interacting with the world based on that over time. So it's like there's the momentary event, but then this long-term process of engaging the world that has changed. And it seems like you have helped people with that, with using therapies to try to recapture whatever it was that they were feeling out of balance with. There are various types of therapies out there that are probably used, cognitive behavioral therapies, exposure therapies, and others. Do you know, what are the general therapies applied that you see in clinical psychology? And then why did you go ahead and choose Inner Resources, which is kind of founded on meditation and mindfulness programs?
You know, most of the first line treatments for stress disorders like PTSD, they call them trauma-focused treatments. They involve disclosure and some integration of what happened. So disclosure of the details of what happened. And so certainly treatments like prolonged exposure and EMDR and DBT and things like STARE that are used for complex PTSD, they all involve to one extent or another detailed disclosure of what happened during the event so that the person can reintegrate it with their current experience. And I do think disclosure is extremely important in resolving trauma for a lot of people. But, you know, when I first started working therapeutically with people who had PTSD, you know, there were people who had disclosed again and again and again, and sometimes after years of therapy, of bona fide mainstream empirically supported trauma therapies, they had experience of a lot of disclosure, but still had a lot of debilitating symptoms from it. And so I started thinking, like, what else do we need to bring? You know, what else can be done that hasn't already been done by these really well-supported treatments, you know, given in settings where people were very trained? It occurred to me that if you think of all the classical definitions of mindfulness, like maintaining the continuity of present moment awareness with non-judgment, you know, with some equanimity, all those things that define mindfulness are deficit in PTSD. And so that was the first thing that struck me when I started working with a very large number of people with PTSD, is those very things. It's almost like PTSD is the opposite of mindfulness, because when you think about it, fundamentally, PTSD involves the discontinuity of present moment attention. And no matter, there's a lot of different symptoms that people have from PTSD. It can be intrusions where they suddenly start thinking of things that remind them of the trauma or responding to situations as though they're back in the trauma. That's a discontinuity of present moment awareness, because if you didn't have that, you could, for example, recall that even though your boss resembles the abuser, the boss is not the abuser, and right, unless there was some discontinuity of your present moment attention, is what causes the problem. And same with avoidance. By it's easier to see why avoidance is associated with discontinuity. If a person is making efforts or sort of inadvertently avoiding thinking about something or avoiding certain emotions, that's a disconnect from their present moment experience. So fundamentally, stress disorders involve disruptions in present moment attention. And so in my early days of working on trauma, I became very interested in dissociation, because dissociation, of course, represents a really radical disruption of a person's present moment attention and their ability to maintain just the continuity of their experience over time in a way that's not disrupted and distorted. And so in the very early days of working with especially highly dissociative, traumatized clients, I thought, how can I keep them? What can I do to help them? And more I found myself incorporating mindfulness as a way for them to track the continuity of their attention and to notice when it was starting to fray, so that they could take proactive measures in a very structured way to not dissociate. And I found it was so surprisingly helpful for people, some of whom had had many years of therapy, sometimes decades of therapy. So that was, you know, that was 25 years ago or something when I started using some integrating mindfulness with trauma therapy to help people self-monitor a little better and say, where's my attention now? And what active steps can I take to maintain the continuity of my attention, even in the face of very distressing triggers for my trauma?
And when you're introducing that for your client, what's that firsthand experience like? Is it too much? For some, does it work immediately and they see what you're trying to get across? What do you have as like case examples of what you've seen, or global examples of what you've seen?
Yeah, and that is such a good question, because it brings our attention to the idea that a mindfulness needs to be titrated for people. So I think about mindfulness and the process of learning it myself or teaching it to other people, and certainly the process of using it clinically, it's really helpful to think of it developmentally, right? Because it represents a set of capacities that people can develop over time. It's not just one thing. It's not just, you know, sit there and watch your breath and then all will be well, right? Because especially in a trauma therapy context, sometimes my students or trainees ask me, well, why don't you just tell people to watch their breath? And I say, if they could do that, they don't need a trauma therapist, right? Because by definition, a person is so prone to those dysregulations, right, of their attention and their emotions, that if they could do that, they don't need me, you know? Fundamentally, the process is explaining to people what the process of dissociation is. And there's a figure in the book that was adapted from John Allen's model of disruptions and dissociation. It was something, a 1993 paper that really influenced me when I was starting this kind of work. So I adapted the figure, and it basically shows that the process of dissociation, so the psychoeducational part about here is what happens to your experience on dissociation. What that figure shows is that, you know, you can be maintaining and going along just fine, you know, sort of tracking your present moment experience and get triggered by something. And that triggers an episode of dissociation where a person can either trance out, they can think that they're someplace else, they can actually be amnestic for it and forget what happened during the dissociative episode. And then at some point they return to their ordinary day-to-day present moment attention, the continuity that makes us functional. And the second diagram shows how mindfulness can help you maintain that even in the face of trauma triggers. And so it's sometimes showing a picture is more important than just describing or giving somebody something to read. And so the point is that by doing a mindfulness practice, by cultivating present moment attention that is predicated on practice, that a person can notice when they're starting to be triggered by something. And even initially, sometimes the experience is that you notice, oh, I just got triggered. What was going on with me right before? So I'll give you an example from, some of my early clinical experience when I was on internship at the New Orleans VA. I had a client who was routinely, as several people were, triggered just walking into the building. You know, park your car in the garage, and then you have to walk up the steps and get in. It was a high barrier for a lot of people because there's so much to trigger you on the way. And this client in particular was triggered by noise, abrupt noises like cars backfiring. The office, our building, the hospital used to be near the Superdome in New Orleans, and there was often helicopters landing, you know, when the artists would be arriving or their crews would be arriving. So unfortunately, I had an office that overlooked the Superdome and you could hear choppers landing. So much to trigger a person. But one quality of PTSD is sometimes people get triggered and they don't even know anymore what triggered them. They just know that suddenly they snap and they're not completely in control anymore of their continuity of their attention and their emotions and sometimes even their behavior. So I had the one client who had a really hard time getting the session because he would get triggered and he'd trance out. Sometimes he'd just get back in his car and drive away. It was too overwhelming. And so I asked him to do some mindfulness practice and just to notice, and especially if he got triggered, just stop in his tracks and say, where did I go just now? And so I gave him some exercises, like he could maintain the awareness of his fingers tips touching his palm. That's something that we learned in session as we practiced together, that he could do that. He could maintain awareness of the sensation of his fingers touching his palm, no matter how disrupted that he got by a trauma reminder. And so I said, great, let's use that. When you arrive and you park your car, take a moment, notice your breath and notice the sensations of your fingers touching your palms and use that as your anchor as you walk through. And he noticed as he did that he could sense his rising distress, that the triggers didn't come all of a sudden completely unexpected, right? That they, what actually happened, and you know, Marsha Linehan talks a lot about this process too, right? That as you self-monitor, you realize you're building up to a real disruption. It doesn't necessarily just come out of the blue. He would notice that he'd start to lose it when he got near the steps to the building. And he was able to use the anchor of his fingertips first and later just breath awareness to scaffold his attention all the way up to get into the elevator. As I did those things, I realized how important mindfulness practice was in helping our clients use the skills we wanted them to have in real time in their real life. And what's important about that is actually trying it in the session first, that the therapist has to be mindfully aware of the client's state and to notice when the person is not fully connected with the present moment and to draw their attention and say, hey, I want to check in with you right now. Where'd you go just now? I've been watching the second hand and it looked like for about 15 seconds, you were kind of tranced out there. Can you remember what happened? And so sometimes I've trained a lot of therapists and I find sometimes people want to like politely ignore it or something, like, and hope it just goes away. Because it's hard to know what to do when our clients trance out, disconnect or become very dysregulated in the session and start getting very upset. It's like we want to patiently wait until it goes by. But I say we do therapy because of those things, not in spite of them. They can be wonderful therapeutic opportunities.
Yeah, and it speaks to your earlier point too, that the role of the therapist versus the go it alone mindfulness approach, that client probably never would have done that on their own, come back to their fingertips if they were at home, heard that sound. They don't have anyone asking them, where were you? Put that trance out in the last 15 seconds. So I totally see the value of them also having the therapist as some form of anchor that they have to come. It pushes them, it motivates them enough, right, to get into the room to be able to do these practices.
It gives them structure. You know, yes. You know, in order to develop self-regulatory capacities, people need structure, just like you need to learn anything, right? If you want to learn how to do a great free throw in basketball, or if you want to learn how to play the piano, any skill or capacity that a person wants to develop requires some period of structure. They need some support and scaffolding to learn a new skill. And they need to practice. And it's helpful to do that in collaboration with an experienced other person, like anything, learning to tie your shoes. And so these mindfulness skills are just the same way. You can learn in collaboration with an experienced other person.
You created that structure in the Inner Resources Program. That's what's detailed in your book. So this is a manualized group-based 9-session program. And you adapted it for trauma recovery. How long have you been working on that program? And when did it become a program for you? It seems like, you know, in our careers and work and working with people, there's a moment where we have the program in mind, whereas before you were just doing your job. When did this materialize for you?
You know, it's funny because I first started meditating. This is going to sound super geeky, and I apologize in advance, but I first started meditating when I was about 8 because I found books in the library about it. And I actually, I contributed to a volume about the psychology of meditation that Michael West edited. And part of that experience was a personal essay about how you got involved. And I was really surprised by that assignment and a little reluctant at first. But then it was actually turned out to be interesting for me because I had to reflect on how did I get involved and why am I doing this? And, so I did start at a very young age based on reading books about it. And, when I, came to Palo Alto, to take a faculty job way back in the last century sometime, my husband and I actually opened a meditation center. Like we were just young and, you know, and young and in love and let's go there and we'll start. So we opened a storefront, believe it or not, and we had a meditation center in there for some years. And, at some point, a senior colleague came to my office, Larry Thompson. He walked in my office and he said, "You do that meditation stuff, don't you?" And I was like, "Who's asking?" You know, because back in 1996 or 97, it wasn't such a common thing. And at that time, I was just doing trauma research. And I was like, "Why do you want to know?" And he goes, "Well, you know, we got this grant, and it's a clinical trial for our dementia family caregivers, and we'd like to include a mindfulness program." And he says, "Do you want to be involved?" And I said, "I'll do it." And he said, "I'm holding the grant right here in my hand. Do you want to read it first?" I said, "You know, I'll read it if you want me to, but I'm in." And so that's how it actually moved from being just something I did in the community and that we did, that we thought of as a community service. And that's how it moved into my professional life, just from that one meeting. And he said, "You know, you're going to need to have a manual. And because this is, you know, proper clinical trial and everything." And I said, "Okay." And he said, "Well, except I need it next week." And I was like, "Okay, I can do it. I know how to do this." So that was actually the very first draft of that manual that you hold in your hands now, was from, you know, Larry, my colleagues, Larry Thompson and Dolores Gallagher Thompson were like, you're in, but we need manualization. We need therapist adherence, you know, signals. We need all those things. So I was like, okay. So that is how it got moved over into my professional life. And we did that experience, and it was really, I was really surprised at how fast it worked for people. And I was really, I feel kind of liberated to be able to, say that the treatment is actually mindfulness training. It's not mindfulness plus something else. What would happen? I asked myself the question, what would happen if we just made mindfulness and meditation the treatment without any attempt to integrate it with other treatment components or techniques that are explicitly drawn from other treatments? What would happen if I explored this? And I was totally prepared to fail. You know, I was totally prepared to find out that effective treatment required incorporation of CBT and other techniques that have been tried and true for so many decades. But I haven't found, and every time I start a new project, I'm prepared to be wrong and say something more is needed. But haven't found that yet. I haven't found that mindfulness and meditation work in a way that's incompatible or inconsistent with, for example, CBT principles. It's just a very different way of doing therapy.
So what are you asking clients to do? Have they previously had treatment when they enter that room? You note the importance of assessment in your book, getting good baseline needs assessment. Are you looking for a certain type of individual and a certain type of need, or where's the average person coming from? And then what are you asking them to do that's perhaps new in a treatment setting?
My perspective on mindfulness is that it's a fundamental human neurodevelopmental capacity. So everybody's got it. It's not something that I give you, right? Everybody has that. Like everybody has some degree of musical ability or some degree of, motor skills. People have it's a part of our normal human experience. So no, I don't expect that people have had previous experience, and the bulk of the many thousands of people we've worked with since, the mid-90s haven't had any experience of mindfulness. And the emphasis on assessment is because of the matching. It's because of having a developmental perspective. You have to understand where the client is starting from and give them things that match their preferences, like what did they want to do? What do they like doing? And also their capacities. How much directness of direct encounter with their own experience can they tolerate? Right. And so the emphasis on assessment is to help the clinician do this really sensitive matching. Because if you give people things that work, you can't hardly stop them from doing them. You know what I mean? There's no persuasion involved. There's no, I'm going to talk the person into it or give them some psychoeducation and convince them that they should start doing a daily mindfulness practice, because that is what we ask people to do, is have a daily meditation practice. But it's not done by persuasion or psychoeducation at all. I never found that works to convince anyone to change their behavior. But what does work is if they have a success experience and then they want to keep doing it. And the success experience flows from finding something that suits the client. And so what we ask them to do, concretely what we ask them to do, is there's these 9 sessions, and each session is divided into thirds. It's a very meditation practice heavy intervention. It's not talking about meditation, it's actually doing it. So the first and last third are meditation practice, and the middle third is kind of discussion, debriefing, and the psychoeducation part, and clients sharing their experience. So 2/3 of each 90-minute session or in actual practice. And then in between sessions, the expectation is to practice at least 30 minutes a day. And the purpose of the middle third of the session, part of the purpose is to fine tune and help debrief the client about what their experience of the meditation was, so that they can, so that the therapist and client together can achieve some kind of match, some kind of way of using the practice that is beneficial for the client.
So practical on the ground use, there is an assessment there is the client reporting that they would be interested in something like this just to start. And then where does the PTSD, say, diagnosis or spectrum of stressor-related disorders come in? Is it a come-all for anyone experiencing major stressors or symptoms related to stress, or are you particularly focusing in on those with the PTSD diagnosis and related symptoms?
Well, you know, over the course of my career, using inner resources for traumatized people has only been a part of that. So it's always been something that we've done for like the whole range of people. We have a clinical trial. We have a randomized controlled trial of inner resources, say for dementia family caregivers who are extremely chronically stressed people who on average do not have a PTSD diagnosis, right? Or a stress disorder. So I have used it in a lot of different contexts, but in the trauma context, what would be important is to check in with the client and find out how important making detailed disclosures is to them. Because some people really want to come and to therapy, and they want the therapy to be about them talking about the details. And if such a person wanted that, they could be referred to a more intensively trauma-focused. I haven't had that happen, you know, in any of our experience. I haven't had anybody say, well, this is just not enough talking about my trauma and hearing about the traumas of others in the group. Like, that hasn't happened. But people should have choices about their treatment, right? We should tell our client, inform our clients about all treatment alternatives. And so we do that. There is the opportunity for people to talk about trauma in the groups, but the focus is on how can I bring these meditation techniques to bear on the particular manifestations that I'm experiencing, right? So it's not based on, like so many trauma treatments are, very importantly, based on very detailed disclosures, you know, and integrating and resolving those disclosures. That's not the emphasis, right? There is some talk. People always talk about what they experience, but we keep it focused on, given that you're having these manifestations of trauma, what in here might you bring to bear, right? To address your particular problems and your particular manifestations of trauma.
Yeah, that's what had me wondering, because if there was this emphasis that people had early on about disclosure, and I know in our group settings, if you're sitting in a mindfulness program, whether it be your program, MBSR, other MAPS programs, whatever it is, at the beginning of the program, we always say what happens in this room is confidential, and whatever is said should remain confidential. With the sensitivity of these issues, is it similar in that way, that people just respect the confidentiality? So someone interested in a group like this, they're not worried. But if they
of
said
course.
Something.
Okay. Yeah, it's therapy just like any other therapy, right? So you set the group norms at the beginning about confidentiality. And I have found that people appreciate the opportunity to come to a group therapy for PTSD, knowing that they're not going to walk in and sit down and have to listen to some extremely disturbing disclosure. Like, people do appreciate that. Like, they say, a lot of clients have said to me, like, it's so relaxing. And also, we start with meditation. You come in, you sit down, and you gather yourself, because we're going to start meditating. And we're not going to start with a lot of chit chatting or griping about, you know, the parking or the, back in the days, remember when we used to have like big parking problems? Remember that, David, back in the day? We don't start with kind of chit chatting or debriefing the irritations of the day. The emphasis is on the meditation, because that is considered to be the active ingredient for the treatment. And so, I find a lot of people have said, I appreciate knowing that I can come here and that we're just going to meditate, and that I can sort of gather myself, and that I feel safe and protected knowing that I'm not going to be kind of slammed with someone else's very disturbing disclosure.
That makes a lot of sense. And in your focus on the positive, I was also thinking about something else and reading your book, that you make a good point. You know, trauma isn't always a negative interpretation by the individual. There can be positive outcomes, right? And you mentioned depth and life a greater meaning, acceptance of larger picture of problems in life, commitment to some bigger goal, and other positive outcomes. So you really had me thinking there, like, in do you see clients uncovering that through my, does mindfulness facilitate that somehow? So when you're present, aware, embodied, and, you know, some of the practices, and I don't know if this is in your program, when you're cultivating some positive, friendly, kindness type emotions, do clients start to see this and the connection, or some only see it? Is it a few? How do those things connect?
You know that in clinical work, there's a couple of different orientations. And one is that we do therapy because we want to return the person to wherever they were at baseline, right? Especially in trauma therapy, there's one perspective that says the person now has a disorder and the aim of therapy is to relieve them of that disorder so that they don't have the symptoms of the disorder and they kind of go back to where they were at baseline. And that is a very important goal. If I go to a therapist for a disorder or I go to a doctor for a medical illness, I want them to get rid of it, you know, and me to be free of it. But, you know, there in psychotherapy, there's also kind of this mysterious line sometimes that we cross to people return to better than baseline functioning, right? They gain new capacities. They gain new insights. They get healthier ways of interacting that open the door to them having experiences that they couldn't have before. So that one, as you bring new capacities and new abilities out into your world, you have the opportunity for new experiences that further enhance your growth. So that, in other words, the gains you make in therapy keep growing and keep developing for you, like planting a garden. You know, there's a lot of messy digging sometimes at the beginning and weeding that you do at the beginning of a garden, but over time it matures and develops and bears fruit. And so I think that's probably the higher goal of almost any kind of psychotherapy, and one that's explicitly addressed by in this approach, right? Because it is a capacity developing. It's using meditation and mindfulness to develop capacities that I think are natural human capacities. I like to say playing the piano is not natural. That's very difficult, right? It's not natural. Most people aren't born, you know, some people are, but most people aren't born knowing how to play the piano. That's not natural. Mindfulness is natural. It's a capacity, like falling asleep is a capacity. And so, yes, it's an explicitly part of the it's an aim of the treatment is that people have new capacities when they leave, and maybe they regained a level of capacity they had before the trauma, but sometimes trauma interrupts the development of these capacities, right? If you think of people who were exposed to a lot of adversity from a very young age, they sometimes don't get the opportunity to develop certain capacities in the context like of a loving attachment relationship. And that doesn't mean they lose out. You still get a chance to develop those because that's part of what it means to be human. So you get another chance to develop that sense of stability and security and contentment.
Yeah, I really liked your point. This idea, it probably was ongoing for a long time, just to get rid of something. Clients wanting us to get rid of things. Therapists thinking they could get rid of things, but it's bizarre now thinking back, right? It's like, wait, how do you get rid of a piece of yourself that you probably will remember until the end of time? Or how can you change your experience and relationship to it? And perhaps that's why mindfulness does work so well.
Yes, that's very nicely put.
Yeah, in that way. So you had me thinking about, you know, one major event when I was young was that I got a major sports injury. And I remember leading up to that point, just feeling like nothing could ever, no harm could come to me because things were going well and I was doing well. And then I separated my shoulder third degree, almost tore it completely. And then all of a sudden seeing myself at like 16 in the physical therapy office, like, oh my goodness, is my life over? In that way. And, you know, of course, those were hard times. And I did go back into sports. You know, losing some love of your life is really hard. Sports was a love of my life. But then, you know, finally integrating that into who I was and looking back and seeing that I'm so glad I had that experience because I know I'm vulnerable now. Going around acting like you're not vulnerable is probably not a good place to be for the rest of your life. And there's an integration of maturity of that. And I always look back on it. I still have a separated shoulder to this very day. But every time I see it, it's just like, oh yeah, remember that? You still are vulnerable, and bad things can happen at any moment. Take caution, but be optimistic. So I totally hear what you're saying.
Because that's a developed milestone, right? That teenagers cross at one point or another, right? Because it's normative as a teenager to feel invulnerable. That's normal, and over time, and as you nicely illustrated in your example, sometimes our life experience challenges and stimulates growth to the next level. And so what a lovely example of how life challenges and setbacks and injuries stimulate our development and reaching that next normative developmental stage. It doesn't mean that you're permanently damaged. What you're telling me is that you had a terrible injury and it stimulated your growth along a normal developmental trajectory. And you do still bear some of the physical effects of it, but you take that maturity with you the rest of your life, right?
Yes, yes. The recognition remains. And that's why it had me thinking about, like, you don't get rid of things, I don't know if you can get rid of things.
So there's stimuli for your growth.
Yeah.
And that's entirely compatible with using mindfulness and meditation for trauma. It's not, the emphasis is not on, let me just erase this thing that happened before, but it happened and it's still with you. And so how do you work with that? Like, what can you bring to bear? You can scaffold the continuity of your tension, even in the face of terrible reminders. And it doesn't mean you're ever going to like it. I think I might've put this example in this book or another place. I had a client who did not disclose during the trauma interview, a terrible experience in an elevator. And when my office moved from, the ground floor of about 8 floors off the elevator bay, the client started dissociating in the session. Like, we'd be talking about the next appointment and all of a sudden he'd be tranced out, kind of staring into space. And neither one of us initially could track what was triggering this, because it certainly wasn't. It's common to dissociate while you're giving a trauma history interview, right? Because you're encountering memories of some of the worst things that ever happened. But this was seemingly random. And this went on for 2 sessions. And the third time I said, I'm going to stop trying to ask questions. I'm just going to observe. So I said, I'm just going to sit here and do my mindfulness. And in about 2 minutes, I realized that when the elevator went bing, how when the door opens on your floor, it goes bing. Well, every time the elevator binged is when he tranced out. And so I said, wait, I want to ask you something. I think I'm noticing something. I think I'm noticing that when the elevator goes bing, that's when this is happening. And he goes, oh yeah, of course. after 2 sessions of trying to piece this together, he's like, yeah, of course. I was like, of course. And he said, yeah. And then he disclosed this other event. So it actually became the focus of treatment, resolving that previous event. And by the end, he was able to ride the elevator without getting overwhelmed by distress. He actually, part of the story I left out is he started complaining bitterly about having to climb the floors of stairs. And as the guy was an athlete, and I was like, okay, you're so buff. You're an athlete. Like, you work out 4 hours a day. Why is walking up 8 flights a problem here? And he couldn't say. And so at the end of treatment, he was able to take the elevator, and he said something like, Lynn, you're never going to make me like elevators, but I can do it now. I can do it. My back's to the wall, my back's to the wall when I ride, but I'm fine. But you're not going to make me like it. And I was like, well, I think that's an appropriate goal. He understands his discomfort. He can connect that experience of triggered stress to what happened to him in the past. And then he can take active measures to work with that and incorporate it and not suffer those constraints that he had before that were imposed by having to avoid elevators. Right. So that's just that's the goal. You don't ever get, it's not like we erase it. But you learn from it and grow.
And so for clinicians and trainees getting excited about your program and about the mindfulness method, you do note in your book potential concerns. What stands out, therapies have concerns across the board. This is not a special case, but in terms of mindfulness in particular, for people with trauma, do you think there are special concerns, like top two concerns?
Well, my main concern is, I like to call it titrating the practice. You know, you adjust or adapt the intensity and the type of practice to the person's needs and capacities. And so my biggest concern about people using this therapeutically is that they do it in a way that is matched to the client, and that they monitor the client's experience by debriefing with them after each meditation period. And it's simple. You just say, how'd that go for you? What was that experience like? Because it's, you can't just look at a person and tell what experience they are having during a period of practice. And it's the most common error, I think, that people make in incorporating mindfulness into therapy of all kinds of mindfulness and all kinds of therapy. I think the most common, what I consider to be an error, is not debriefing the client, because you don't know what they're experiencing and what they're doing. And in the specific example of PTSD or other trauma disorders, is you have to monitor for the possibility that the person is actually meditating and they're not dissociating or suffering some intrusive experience. And it's easily remedied. Like I say, you check in with people and say how you're doing right now. What are you experiencing?
It's well stated. And, you know, there's an interesting piece of your book that you brought up, this model. It's a pre-existing model, but it really had me thinking that it's called the zone of proximal development. And your description of it says it's focused on clients, but I thought for all of us, it's actually very interesting about us and our relationship to our life and consciousness. It says it's a model that shows us there's something the client can do in the current moment, the things that they can do with this term called scaffolding, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about that, and the things that the clients or we cannot yet do. And it really had me thinking about a meditation itself also. When someone goes in the room and you're trying to help them find an experience of what meditation feels like, they might be able to do some things, not all. And then you recognize, oh, they really aren't going to be able to do something for a while. Why did you bring this model up? I mean, I really liked it, but why did you bring it up more broadly in its relationship with your program?
You know, it reflects, so it's based on the zone of proximal development that Vygotsky talked about. And this is an idea that has a lot of currency in educational psychology. You know, I think Vygotsky initially used it to describe children's acquisition of cognitive skills, developmental acquisition. But it's a term has been adopted a lot in education and educational psychology, but it has a lot of appeal to me for application of psychotherapy, because the main idea, you know, the diagram that you're talking about shows three concentric circles. And in the middle circle is things that the client can do on their own, like without any help for you. And I think the example is, they can get in touch with negative emotion, right? Because in PTSD, there's a lot of experience of negative emotion almost exclusively. And then the concentric circle that's around that inner ring is a zone of proximal development, things the client can do in collaboration with a knowledgeable other person, right? So you may be able to support and challenge the client into experiencing positive and negative emotions at the same time. And the things in the outer concentric circle are things the client can't do even with scaffolding. So for example, they can't maintain their equanimity in the face of serious trauma triggers is the example. But the reason I think that's important is because as therapists, and by the way, as people, we always want to go straight to the end of the story. You know, we want to achieve the ideal aims. Like we want to be able to not be bothered and be peaceful and happy all the time. But the diagram shows that that's the outcome of a developmental process. Right. And so I used to teach child and adolescent psychotherapy for many years. And the example that I would give is that when a child who is, let's give the example of a child whose parents are undergoing a very high conflict divorce, but the child is normatively egocentric. They're going to come in and say what? They're going to say, it's my fault, you know, that my parents are breaking up and it's all my fault. And, you know, they're normatively egocentric. So you can't. What the therapist wants to do is to jump in and say, oh, no, it's not your fault. Sometimes things happen to adults that have nothing to do with the kids. That's a hard sell for a younger kid who's normatively, who hasn't acquired the capacity of perspective taking. And so as much as it might be the therapist's impulse to reassure or do therapy on the client to reach that end stage of development, it might not be accessible to someone based on where they are right now. And so, you know, you're making a really interesting observation, David, that it kind of applies to ourselves too. You know, if you think about classical depictions of meditation, they show perfection. They show bliss, you know, they show utter peace and equanimity. And so we think, well, meditation must be that. And if I don't get that the first three times I try it, I must be doing it wrong or it doesn't work. And so that's disturbing, right? Because achieving the outcomes, you know, having an experience of meditation is predicated on some development, right? And every time I meditate, it's a different experience. That's how I don't get bored after so many, you know, after 50 years or so of this. That's why I'm not bored of it yet, because I get a new experience every time. And so that zone of proximal development shows that we shouldn't try to demand or expect of our clients that they just experience the end stage of whatever. And I think it applies to all therapy, right? Because you want the client to be well and to be done. It's a little bit like I heard you talking with Judson Brewer on the last one about the conventional treatment for smoking cessation, which is just like set yourself a goal and in 2 weeks you're done. And it's like, no, there's a developmental process that has to, some other things need to move around before that happens, right? There's a developmental progression. It's almost like it's on this diagram, it would be like the therapist pointing to that outer concentric circle and say, yeah, in 2 weeks you'll just be here. All you have to do is make up your mind. When we all know what you all discussed was there's some other things that needed to happen first to support the person's learning and development toward that end. And so it's especially important with meditation because there's all these popular images, you know, of, oh, you'll be so peaceful if you meditate and, you know, you won't be bothered by anything. You know, there's all these popular conceptions that a lot of therapists also believe. And so it points to the idea that it's a developmental process, that you start from where you are. You don't have to have any special skills or experience or special qualities or talents. You just start from wherever you are and then take the next step forward. And that in collaboration with another, like a therapist or like other people in the group, in collaboration, you can be supported and scaffold to reach that next step of development.
That's very well put, and I enjoyed that in your book. And so just a final question for you. I came across your work, and maybe you were doing this for a while, but some recent publications on perhaps disaster treatment in Southeast Asia, and what is going on there, and what's your future look like for your work and your program?
You know, funny thing, David, which is that many years ago, this is kind of when I first started my faculty position at Palo Alto University. The first grant I got was to study catastrophic flooding in Northern California. And at that time, my mentors were saying, oh, don't bother, you know, why are you bothering with disaster? Such a small percentage of people actually get PTSD. It's a single digit, you know, in some of the studies. Single digit percentage, you're going to end up with PTSD. From a PTSD researcher, that is not, disaster is just not very interesting. And it's like, I'm so sorry to say that that's wrong, that now now all these years later, you know, 25 years later, we realize that disasters have major impact and they seem to be coming faster and faster. And there's a recognition of the profound impacts that it has. And unfortunately, sorry to say, there seem to be a lot more disasters than there ever were before. It's a trend that we're on. And so the issue at hand is like, what is the thing to do when on a population basis, people get severely stressed. And in the case of the Philippines, where I did some work with colleagues at Ateneo University, Gina Hechinova and other people, there's this idea that, you know, after Super Typhoon Haiyan, there were 11 million people that were affected. And it was not a low-level event. It was horrible. And what's the thing to do? You can't just deploy, you know, legions of trauma therapists to go out on a population basis. So the question we asked ourselves is, what would be appropriate to roll out kind of on a population basis under conditions of such extreme stress? And I didn't start with the assumption that mindfulness was going to be helpful. I asked it more as a question than as a statement. And it turned out to be rated very highly among all the treatment components in the intervention that we developed, Katatagan. And so, you know, I also did some work in Northern Ireland with peace building. And the Minister of Health asked me the same question. He says, what do you want me to do? Just hand out antidepressants to everybody? Or you want me to get trauma therapists for the whole country? Because as you might know, epidemiological work shows a very high proportion of people exposed to traumatic events and having trauma symptoms in Northern Ireland. So what is the thing to do? And it turns out it looks like one of the things you can do is offer trauma-informed mindfulness training, something that you can roll out on a population basis. It's not necessarily offered as therapy in that context, but it is offered as kind of a public health intervention that can be deployed rather readily. And it's also helpful for the disaster workers who get highly exposed, you know, vicariously and directly exposed. So that's kind of what the thinking was there.
And are you going to continue that work? Is this where you're headed on international work or?
We continue to do projects. And so there's probably other things coming up. Right now, my focus is really on rolling out trainings for this, the book that just came out. So there's several, you know, recorded trainings that are available on the internet. But so at the very moment, the most proximal goal is just roll out training so that there's some material to go with that book. And so weirdly, this is all in recorded webinar now, and none of it in person really at the moment. So that's the immediate goal, is just to put out some more of those trainings so that I feel like there's some guidance about how to use the book. Because, of course, none of us can learn a therapy just merely from reading a book.
Well, congratulations on your book. And let's conclude for today. Thank you, Dr. Waldie.
Well, listeners, thank you, Dr. Black. It's been lovely.
Wonderful having you. Listeners can find our recordings at goamra.org. That's goamra.org, where you can support us by becoming a member or a subscriber. That's it for today. Bye now.